Good evening and welcome to this panel discussion on storm safety preparedness presented as part of KGOU's Ahead of the Storm, the Oklahoma Tornado Project. Funding for this project comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm KGOU News Director Kurt Gwartney, and with me are Michael Ann Uden, Deputy Director with the State Office of Emergency Management, Rick Smith, Warning Coordination Meteorologist with the Norman Forecast Office of the National Weather Service, and Harold Brooks, Senior Scientist with the National Severe Storms Laboratory. Welcome to each of you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Our topic this evening is all about being ready, knowing where to go, what to do, and how to prepare for our upcoming spring storm season. And to provide some structure to our discussion, I'm going to first ask our experts about how Oklahomans, how we as residents here should prepare based on where we are, and then also how that might be a little different depending on where we are. And we'll just start off, Michael Ann, with you. So I'm at work. I work in an office building, let's say in downtown Oklahoma City. What do I need to do? How do I need to think about that environment being prepared for a possible severe storm or tornado in my area?
Well, I think you hit it on the nose. You may not be home whenever severe weather occurs, so you need to have a plan for where you're going to be safe, how you're going to shelter in place, or any other actions you need to take, depending on whether you're at work, at church, at a community gathering, whatever the case may be. You need to be mindful of that, and you need to have a plan. Most important thing is to have a plan before the storm hits. We find it's a little difficult. There's anxiety and other things that set in. If you don't plan ahead of time, it's much more difficult to plan when the tornado or other severe weather's on the way.
And how would that office environment work? Would there be specific recommendations you might make for someone who works in a downtown office high-rise building?
Well, certainly in a high-rise building, the first thing that comes to my mind is glass, and you'd want to be away from that, and you'd want to be at the lowest level you could get to, and the centermost place in that structure.
And those are words most Oklahomans are familiar with.
Well, we've grown up hearing it, exactly.
Rick, what about a place like school or church? Those are very large, kind of open buildings with a lot of people. Any recommendations for how we might think, and those of us who have kids in school, how as parents we might think about getting ready if we have children in those locations?
Well, all three of us are probably going to sound like a broken record because we're all going to say, get as low as you can, put as many walls between you and the tornado as possible. That will take care of you everywhere. I mean, that's the basic overarching tornado safety guidelines no matter where you are. Follow up real quickly on something on Michael Ann's question. One of the things, if I worked in a high-rise building in downtown Oklahoma City, a key part of being ready for storms is paying attention to the weather. And if it's 5 o'clock and it's time for you to leave that high-rise building in downtown Oklahoma City, don't get in your car and drive if there's storms between you and your house. So that's a basic thing. We may talk about cars later. Schools, churches, we think any place where people gather need to obviously have an organized severe weather safety plan that includes multiple ways to get a warning, that includes places to seek shelter. And in Oklahoma, it's not enough to just plan to shelter the people that are actually there. Sometimes you have to shelter hundreds of people that show up to take shelter in one of those places. So certainly, you know, schools, churches, any public gathering facility should have a plan of action. Identify the locations that offer the best protection that they have available from the tornado, with the theory, again, being getting as far inside the building as you can, putting as many walls or barriers between you and the outside as you can, and being as low as possible.
Harold, so I'm shopping at the big box store looking for an electrical outlet that I need to put in, and the tornado comes. There aren't any walls. The center is nothing under a huge span. And I know that the situation kind of occurred in Joplin. So what do I do if I'm caught out shopping in this situation?
Well, I think one of the most important things is that you need to be aware of the threat of the possibility of severe weather before you go shopping. Going to a big box store is probably not the best idea during a tornado watch, especially if storms are relatively close, because they are they're just not built to handle a tornado at all. And then we did see that big problem in Joplin. And so being aware and knowing whether you should postpone that trip, do you really need the electrical outlet before the tornado or not? And can you decide? And then making an intelligent decision to not be in a bad place. And a lot of that is really the heart of any plan is making sure that you're in as good of a place as you can be when the event occurs.
And I'm sure we're going to be hearing the word plan a lot. And that's my next question. And, Rick, we're going to start with you. There have been several situations where the National Weather Service will issue statements, you know, several days out before an event that they predict we might see tornadoes or there's a significant risk for tornadoes. So let's say 3 to 5 days out, this information is coming from your office. How should I take that information in, and then how should I be looking at my plan once I know that this risk is increased in the days ahead?
That's a great question. And in most, well, all of the large tornadoes that we've had over the past several years, that exact scenario has happened. We've been talking about those events for days. We started talking about the May 20th tornado potential for severe weather on that day on May 15th. That far out, it's just an outlook, and we obviously cannot pinpoint where exactly the tornadoes or severe weather are going to happen, or even if it's guaranteed to happen. But the Norman Forecast Office of the National Weather Service is pretty conservative, and if you hear us talking about it 5 days out, you should probably pay very, very close attention to it. What I would be doing that far out is, first of all, realizing that it's not exact, realizing that it's just providing you a heads up. So if I'm telling you 3 to 5 days from now there's a potential for tornadoes, think about what you're going to be doing 3 to 5 days from now. Do you have a trip to go to your daughter's soccer tournament in Tulsa? Well, you need to start thinking about that. Are you going to be at church at 6 o'clock on a Sunday evening? Are you going to be driving home from work? That's the time in that looking out into the long-range future to start thinking about that. Do you have a weather radio? Do you have three ways to get a warning? What does your kit look like? Do you need to vacuum out the spider webs out of your storm shelter? That kind of thing. I mean, those are the kinds of things that those outlooks are good for. You can't, you know, that's not the time to pack up the car and, you know, go on vacation. Well, maybe it is. But if you're going to do it, that's probably the time to do it. But that's the time to just start thinking in your head, okay, it's April or May or June in Oklahoma. Here we go. Am I ready for it? If it happens, what am I going to do?
Michael Ann, in your job as Deputy Director of the Office of Emergency Management, my guess is when you hear that information from the Norman Forecast Office or from the Tulsa office, because you do cover the entire state, that you have things to get ready for. Tell me just a little bit, give me a little bit of insight into how the Office of Emergency Management prepares for one of these possibly significant tornado events.
Well, absolutely. One of the first things, actually, is we're so blessed by the great forecasting capability and the technology that's available through our partners here. They're so locally stationed, and that helps us out a great deal. And Rick's absolutely right. Whenever Rick and the other partners there at National Weather Service and the Severe Storms Lab come forward and say, this is going to be a serious situation, we do heed that. One of the first things that our employees have to do, though, is make sure that their home, their family situation is good. And we preach that they need to have a plan for their loved ones at home as well. I am less efficient and productivity is not as good on my part if I'm worrying about my family. So this is one of the first things, and that could apply to a lot of the first responders as well as others out there that would assist during any kind of disaster. But from the Emergency Operations Center at the State Capitol in Oklahoma City, we work there getting ready for what may be coming our way. And the first people we reach out to, in addition to National Weather Service, is our local emergency managers. They're the boots on the ground. They are our number one customer, if you will, because they are the ones who are going to have the eyes and ears right there to be able to tell us what's going on and be able to get a hold of us if they need any assistance. So we reach out to them and make sure basic things like contact information is up to date. Do they know anything? Is there a special needs population in their community that they're concerned about? Those kind of things. And we just have those conversations. We have a number of conference calls and all of that occurs. But again, I want to stress, it's not just what's happening at your business, but what's happening at your home.
Harold, how is your family prepared for storms?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that being someone who, in theory, knows more than the average person about what's going on, we have a whole series of different kinds of plans. If I'm at home, things are different than if I'm not at home, because
yeah.
That's just
yeah.
My wife and my kids know there are certain things to do. For instance, my kids know that, you know, if it's a potential severe weather day, we aren't doing things like, you know, watching a DVD on TV to where we can't get local information at all. that they are aware of being ready to get information and being prepared for the fact that they may need to do something. My daughter spent the last 3.5 years in Stillwater, and so just trying to make sure that she's aware, and that when she was in the sorority house, that you know, making sure that there was a plan for the house, so that she could be sort of a leader in that role. And so we have an in-residence shelter as the walk-in closet of our bedroom, and so the kids know what to do if they need to get into that and get the dogs in there. My wife's a school teacher, and so obviously she's got responsibilities at school that she has to make sure that she's ready for. But we probably, my wife and children are quicker to go to shelter than I am. But that's, in some sense, that's because I can go look at the radar and I can go, you know, it's going to miss us by a couple of miles. We're actually okay here. And, or I'll wait to go in at the last minute until it's like this is really a serious situation. Whereas they know essentially if the warning comes out for Cleveland County or if the sirens go off, they're going in. And they aren't even going to try to make an interpretation on their own.
The idea of warnings, and Rick, you actually mentioned we need to have multiple ways to receive warnings came up. And, of course, one of those is the NOAA weather radio, which I know in our family, you know, that sits on the bedside, and we wait for that Wednesday noon and Wednesday evening test to make sure it's working, especially as spring arrives. But not everybody has one of those, and people depend on a lot of different ways to get their information. So, Rick, I want you to start off by telling us just a little bit about, kind of give me the list of what you would put as priorities in terms of receiving that information. What are kind of your primary sources, maybe secondary sources, and then we'll go from there.
Well, yeah, we really encourage people to have multiple ways. And when we work with our emergency management partners, certainly they have multiple ways to get a warning. And every single person that lives in Oklahoma needs to have more than one way, and preferably three ways. And having three apps on your phone doesn't count as three ways, by the way.
So that would be one way. I mean, you're basically saying the phone is one way.
The phone is one way. But as anybody that's lived through a significant severe weather event here in the Oklahoma City metro area, one of the first things to go when we have a tornado in the area is the cell phone service. So you may very well get that warning on your app, but it could be 45 minutes later. It just depends. That's dependent on the cell phone service. Television is the number one way people had to get weather information here. When we do surveys and talk to people, you get it all there. You get the pictures, you get the words, you get descriptions, video, helicopter, you get, you know, there's nowhere else like it in the world than the weather information we get here on television. We're fortunate to have those partners who help us get the word out about what's going on. But that's not going to work if your power's out or you lose your cable or your DirecTV or Dish Network or it's 2:30 in the morning when it happens. So you can't rely on just that. So weather radio is at the top of my list for everybody. For $30, you can get a radio that has a battery in it that you can program for your county and that will sound an alarm, and it will wake you up. We have one in our bedroom, too. And it will wake you up and let you know, go turn on KGOU, go turn on your favorite TV station, and see what's going on. So weather radio is at the top of the list. One of the things that is on most people's list, but that, in my opinion, should not be as high as it is outdoor warning sirens. Outdoor warning sirens are a valuable tool, and lots of people heard those during the May tornadoes, and it saved lives, probably, because people took it seriously. The problem is that people rely on those too much, and people wait to hear that siren, and in the absence of the siren, they think the tornado is not going to happen. Some people, it's like the siren is the signal that opens the gates to the city that lets the tornado come in, and it can't happen until the sirens sound. And we just don't want people to rely solely on that or wait for that. Some people will literally, we've talked to people that literally sit on the couch and wait. Yeah, I knew there was a warning. Yeah, I knew it was dark outside. My power went out. I saw debris falling, but I never heard the siren, so I didn't take shelter. And that's scary. I mean, so that can't be your only way. So really, just have multiple ways. An app is a good thing to have, but don't depend on it. Weather radio, TV, sirens, subscription services, communities offer push notifications where they'll send you messages. There's really no excuse anymore to say it struck without warning.
And Office of Emergency Management actually has a way to receive warnings through the phone. Is that not right, Michael Ann?
Well, absolutely. We have a system that you can set up, go to our website, and you can subscribe to get those warnings as well. And basically, we're getting the National Weather Service information directly to you. I'm like Rick, the partners in the media are extremely important, and I know there are multiple apps out there that you can sign up for as well, and I don't think you can sign up for too many is what it comes down to. But again, like he said, anything on your cell phone, that's one. We preach that, and we really believe that. The multiple ways of getting that information is extremely important, and we've seen it save lives.
Harold, in terms of some of the newer ways people get information, for example, social media, Twitter, that kind of thing, I noticed in particular during the Canadian County El Reno event last year that there were Twitter messages being shared that seemed like it was like current information, but in fact, when you would go back and look, you would discover it was actually quite old. Has there been any investigation or looking into how social media informs the way we approach storms?
Well, last week, or was it even earlier this week?
Last week.
Last week. The Weather Service Office actually did an experiment in which they put out a message on Twitter and asked people to retweet it just to see how things moved. And when people noticed, and I'll admit I was someone who didn't notice in the first few minutes because I was at dinner and wasn't thinking about the fact that I know we're about to have this experiment that I should be participating in. But that, you know, there were a lot of people who didn't get the message for 15 to 20 minutes after it had happened, and then they put it out. And if you look at it, unless you see it at 5:37 p.m. this was occurring, you actually don't know what event that tweet is referring to. And the same thing with Facebook. That's a real challenge. We're going to do some work this summer with a summer student who's actually going to try to look at essentially the propagation of both good and bad messages and how long messages go out. For instance, I have a lot of friends. Rick's children have gone to the school my wife teaches at, and so all the teachers at Whittier follow Rick on Twitter. And when he puts something out, that message gets out to them in a very rapid way. What we'd like to know compared to, say, Rick putting something out or my next-door neighbor who knows, as far as I know, nothing at all about weather, putting out a tweet about weather, to some people those two messages look the same. And so how can we look at how good messages go and things that have specific time and space location and the latency effect of what's going on? Because I know that on May 20th, you could still see messages at 5 o'clock about the tornado that was entering Moore. If you were using that, you'd be very badly informed.
And I know that even applies, Rick, in terms of pictures. I've noticed, too, that pictures will get sent out of something. And then often someone from your office will go, that was from like 3 years ago. That's not a real event. Right. So how do we, in this day and age, I think most of the time, if somebody I know tells me something, I'm going to take it a little more seriously and personally and directly than if I get it from the Office of Emergency Management or even the National Weather Service in Norman. How should a person approach information when there's so much happening and they want to know and they're hungry for that? How do you filter that? How do you be prepared to really focus on the information you need to know?
That's a great question. And there is, if you had asked me 10 years ago, is it possible to have too much weather information? I would have said no way. I think it is now because there are so many sources of weather information, some of them official, some of them reliable. Honestly, there are some very slick-looking Facebook pages out there that have very shiny, official-looking graphics that are run by a 12-year-old kid on his mom and dad's laptop who has no background in meteorology and has no clue what he's even talking about. And people, they may have tens of thousands of followers following that. It's very hard for people to distinguish when someone posts a weather graphic or a picture or a radar image that looks very official. Well, it looks good to me, so, they share it and then that propagates. What I'm telling people this year is just find reliable, known, trusted sources of information. A local television meteorologist, a local radio station, the local National Weather Service office, local emergency manager, the Moore Emergency Management office is on Twitter. Follow them. Just don't randomly and blindly share things and retweet things and like things that where you don't know the source, because it can look really legit, it can look really official and really like it's current information and not be. And going back to Harold's, the question you asked Harold a minute ago, one of the things we're doing to combat some of that is in time-sensitive information, we're trying to put a time stamp on it. So if it's the Moore tornado, I think most of the tweets we did during the tornado said 3:01 p.m., tornado emergency. So that reduces the likelihood of it getting I mean, I've seen tornado tweets 2 days after the event still being retweeted and pictures, and it's very confusing.
Michael Ann, any work in your area on developing and using, strengthening maybe the use of social media, even though we obviously are running into some difficulties in getting timely, accurate information in that way?
Well, I think Rick hit on it. It's about, we're back to planning and researching and knowing which one of those sites or which page you're going to follow and all of these different organizations that are out there. And again, you have to do that research ahead of time and know which groups, which entities you're going to rely on to keep you and your family and your business and other places safe.
Harold, I want to go back to the El Reno event and ask you this question. One of our neighbors where we live, who was sheltering with us, had her iPad and was, you know, looking at a tornado picture, an image from a website. And as far as I know, she has absolutely no experience or knowledge in how to use that. What are some of the – and I know there are a lot of people who have these apps, and they will look at the radar signatures to kind of decide when they need to take shelter and when to be safe or not. What are some of the risks and the problems with doing that?
Well, I'll say this, even for as someone who's, you know, has a PhD in atmospheric sciences, there are times when radar interpretation is not easy, especially if I haven't been sitting there watching the radar evolution for the whole afternoon. And it doesn't happen very often with the fact that I have a real job, that even if I just occasionally glance over, I don't get the full picture of what's going on. And if I just get a single snapshot look at the radar, I can be very confused as to what's going on. And that's, I think, one of the things that I value from the forecast office is the fact that I know what – I've been in forecast offices during outbreaks, and I know what they're doing. And so I know the level of attention they're putting to the events, and so their interpretation tends to be really solid, and they tend to be. Rick said something I think very important earlier, that the Norman Forecast Office is a relatively conservative office in terms of warnings, and in terms of procedures. That doesn't mean they're going to let events go by, but they don't hype minor events, and I think that's a really important thing. That if they say something's happening. With severe thunderstorms, you've got a real good chance that that's what's actually going on, because they're experienced, they've got good procedures, and the office interacts very well with each other. This is if it isn't the best office for tornado and severe thunderstorm warnings, I don't know what is, and I think that's an important thing, is that it takes a lot to learn how to read radar. And especially as new products become available and the radars change, and you can see different radar displays of the same storm and just different, even from the same radar, and they've been processed differently, and they look different, and the map background may be different, and you really need to know sometimes exactly where something is to a pretty fine degree, and I think that's one of the things that I mean, I'll look at radar and I'm, you know, I can pick out the hook echo and all that, but there are more complicated situations sometimes in which I pay attention to what these guys do, so I know when they say something, I know what that means.
And sometimes that radar information, depending on the app where you're getting it, actually can be also be old. Isn't that right?
It can be horribly old sometimes, and you don't and you may not know. You better make sure that the app has a timestamp on the radar image. So you can realize, oh, I haven't gotten a new image for 25 minutes. I'll bet that storm's a whole lot closer to me than it looks like on
the radar data is always old. There's no way to see live radar data. If you're watching a TV station where they have their own radar where it's turning and you're seeing it, that's as about as live as you're going to get. You're not going to get live radar on an app or on a computer. Doesn't matter what app you use or how much you pay for it. It's old, and it's sometimes several minutes old. And like Harold said, there's been instances where people didn't see a timestamp or didn't know that the radar that it had stopped, their app had stopped updating, and looking at something that's, you know, 15 or 20 minutes old, and that can be a big problem.
Harold kind of referred to this, and Rick, I'm going to stick with you and ask this question. And I know growing up, being a native Oklahoman, tornado warnings used to involve counties, and then it kind of became county, and now we're down to closer to an area. But still, I think it's that familiarity that we have growing up in the state. And, you know, while I've been affected by tornadoes, it's been fairly indirectly just personally. How do you express the information and the urgency of a situation that's life-threatening to people who might shrug their shoulders because, yeah, I've heard them say that before?
Well, that's a challenge. And like we've talked about a couple of times, you know, we don't talk like we talked on May 19th and May 20th and May 31st all the time. We only do it when we really are confident that it's going to happen. So it really means something. We don't say the sky is falling every single time there's a risk of thunderstorms or that there's even a risk of tornadoes. There are tornadoes and there are tornadoes. And we try to reserve that strongest language. And what we do is there are things that we do for the public and there are things that we do for our partners. Michael Ann mentioned earlier the conference calls and the webinars that we do. We have such a strong relationship with our partners in public safety, fire, police, emergency management especially, that it's almost like they can hear by the tone of our voice or the words that we say or how we word something on a Facebook post or a tweet if we really mean it this time or not. So that's hard to bottle and get everybody to do. For the public, I mean, we try to just reserve that wording. We try to be as specific as we can with the timing. The past several events, we've been able to nail down pretty well several hours in advance, even before the watch comes out. You know, this 2-county-wide area, this 3-hour time span has the highest risk. So the more specific we are, the more conservative we are with using the really scary language, hopefully that gives people confidence. Now, we know people are not going to go just based on what we say, though. We know people are going to flip through the TV stations and go on the internet and see if their friends are excited about it on Facebook and Twitter, and we know that happens. But our role, I think, here is to be really the science-based, just the facts, and just telling people what we think is going to happen. If we're worried about it, we want people to understand how worried we are about it.
And one thing that could help with that we talked earlier about preparation, is it's really important to know what county you live in and what counties you're close to. Like my kids, by the time they were 7, they didn't know any of the counties to the east. I mean, Lincoln and Pottawatomie County are that's forever away. But yeah, Caddo, Grady County, hey, we're good on those counties. And know what they look like on the map. We're actually really fortunate around here. You know, there's that big square thing in the middle, and there are the two triangular things just below it. I was in Columbus, Ohio several years ago in a tornado warning, and I realized all the counties are just these kind of weird-shaped things. I had no clue on their little map up in the corner where I was. And so I'm going, hey, somebody's getting hit really hard pretty soon, and I hope it's not me, because I don't know where I am on this map. And then the satellite went out, so I couldn't see the TV anymore, so everything was okay. I couldn't see it. But that's one of the things. And there are things like we've done some survey work with people about what they understand about their place-based understanding of where they are, and found things like the phrase I-35 corridor. Mm-hmm. There were people who go, am I in the I-35 corridor? Well, that's an interesting question.
What's a corridor?
What's a corridor? How wide is it? Is the corridor, you know, just the 4 lanes on the road or 6 lanes? Or is it, you know, miles on either side? And that was one of those things I think that certainly from the professional side, we're trying to figure out, well, how do we say things as unambiguously as possible, given that people, we think we're saying I know where the I-35 corridor is, heck yeah. But that I don't know if we can actually communicate that and the people will understand it in the same way. But know what county you're in and the counties near you.
Know your county. Sounds like a good geography quiz for our elementary students. Michael Ann, so the storm has come. It hit my neighborhood. I emerged from my closet, and while I seem to be okay, I look around, and it's just destruction. What are some of the first things I should do? Kind of give us a checklist as an emergency management leader as to what you would hope that people would do when they first emerge in that horrible site.
Well, I think the first thing that you would do naturally is check on yourself. Are you okay? Take inventory of your physical situation and any loved ones you had with you whenever you went into that sturdy closet, hopefully. The second thing is something you would have done before you went into that closet, and that is, in my case, if a tornado is coming toward my home, before I get into my storm shelter, I'm going to let someone know I'm getting in there so that after the storm comes through, if I'm not calling them back or texting them back or something, somebody needs to come looking for me because they know where I'm at. I think that's one of the most important things to do. And it gives people some sense of relief when they do go into those safe spots, if you will. And then the next thing is, I think it's just a natural thing, especially here in Oklahoma. You will see people trying to check on their neighbors and all of that. But just be very careful of that, because there may be electric lines down. There may be a whole host of hazards out there to greet you. The very good news is that very soon you should see some first responders. And possibly the media, even before the first responders sometimes. We understand that. But they're part of our partners as well. And as far as the first responders, just do what they say, please. If they say this area is not safe and we need you to move out, please do that, because they're doing it for your own safety. And then gradually, more and more information will come through. You'll start getting more of your bearings. But it is a lengthy process, and we understand that.
And when you go into shelter, you've got to do simple things, like make sure you got shoes.
Exactly.
The number of injuries that happen after the tornado, because people come out and they survive the tornado uninjured, and then they step on a nail or something like that. Make sure you're
very
capable.
Good point.
And that's those little things like that that people don't necessarily think about, especially if it's late in the evening and you're getting ready for bed. And, you know, you don't think about putting on shoes or taking in, you know, the helmet to protect your head, your checkbook, so that if you have to do something with money, you've got something.
Michael, and after those situations, I know that those first responders are obviously looking for victims, people who need that immediate assistance and help. Is there something I can do ahead of time to help that process along? Is there any way to let those people know kind of where I might be and what's going on?
Well, absolutely. And after this storm has come through and you've survived it, there's going to be systems set up. They're going to be announced. There's going to be websites you can go to let your friends and family know where you're at. I believe the Red Cross has one that we always turn to. And then there may be local phone numbers set up and all that, again, so that you can let your loved ones know where you're at. Because as already been mentioned here tonight, is that phone system goes down quite often. And sometimes it's not because of the damage from the storm. It's sometimes just because of the overload of use. So, again, we're back to, in your planning, have those systems in place that you've already identified how you're going to get a hold of people. Maybe you tell your loved ones and your friends, our safe place is going to be the local store within another mile of you, or something like that, that you can all know ahead of time that this is going to be our meeting place if we can possibly get there, so that we can make sure that our loved ones are okay.
We're going to open up the floor to questions in just a few moments. So if you have those, be thinking of them. We'll have microphones come around, and we'll have that here in just a moment. So Rick and Harold both, I think really for you two, based on what we're seeing in the latest research, what are some of the things I can do that make a difference to my survivability long term, other than moving somewhere? But are there things that I can do with my property, where I live, and how I just operate day to day that are going to increase my possible survivability if the worst happens? And Rick, why don't you start?
Well, I think we've already touched on some of it. If you live here in Oklahoma in the springtime and there's a chance of thunderstorms in the forecast, you need to be paying extra attention. You need to be not changing your daily life every time there's a risk of severe weather, but be mindful when there is that risk. Have multiple ways to get a warning. Things like that make a huge difference, because the warnings are getting better. And for the big tornadoes, you may have 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 minutes of warning in some cases, but that does no good if you can't get it. So those sources of information, paying attention to the weather, being plugged into multiple information sources. Another thing that you can do that kind of ties back into Michael Ann's question a minute ago is lots of communities have a storm shelter registration program where you can actually register with the fire department or the emergency management office and say, hey, I've got a storm shelter here. Don't forget to come look for me if something happens. And a lot of communities have that in the area, so take advantage of that. You know, have a kit, have a plan, practice the plan, think about it on a nice, quiet, sunny, early March day when it's 55 degrees and there's no storms out in western Oklahoma. The more that you do that, the more that you think days or weeks in advance, every little bit you do days or weeks in advance is going to take off a huge amount of stress and a huge amount of tension when it comes to actually happening. when that warning comes out, your reaction should be automatic and it should be instant, okay? We've practiced. I know what to do. Here's my shoes. We got our jeans on. We got our long sleeve shirt on. There's my car keys, wallet, cell phones charged. I know where to go and I'm going there. But that doesn't work. You can't start doing that when the tornado warning is issued. You have to do that today. And those are the kinds of things I think of when I think of tangible things that all of us can do that will make a difference when it happens.
Harold, I've been seeing some things pop up about garage doors that I want to ask about, that garage doors often fail and cause problems for houses. Are there any things in terms of the way we actually, where we live and what we build in terms of single family homes that might help us survive?
Sure. Well, and a lot of this depends upon whether you're doing new construction or not. I mean, obviously, if retrofitting is anything is much more expensive than new construction. When my wife and I, when we did an addition onto our house, is when we did essentially everything we possibly could. And then you want to make sure you've got what they call a continuous load path through your house. You want to make sure that the sill plate is attached to the foundation. You've got nuts. You got bolts with nuts on them. Yeah, you want to put the nuts onto the bolts. They don't always do that. Strap those down. That helps hold the walls down to the floor. And put what are called hurricane clips attaching your roof to the walls. Those kinds of things on a $100,000 house add $500 to $1,000 to the cost. And they dramatically increase the load that it takes to tear your house apart by basically a factor of 30 or 40. I mean, you've really added a lot to what is. And building an in-residence shelter when you do that. And think about all the things about, in terms of your space that you actually have in your home, whether that is an underground or, in my wife and I's case, my wife has had back and knee problems, and we realized there may come a time in life when three or four steps is, she can't do it. And so ours is actually is our walk-in closet to our off of our bedroom. And those, it's built to the FEMA standards. If my shelter goes, all of central Oklahoma's gone. Because, I mean, it's going to survive anything. The guy who poured the concrete asked if he could come over to our house. We weren't sure about that. But that was, it's the kind of thing. You know, and the plans are easily available online. Even if you want to custom build it, you take your plans to your architect and your builder, and they are very simple for them to follow. And so those kinds of things, making sure your house has that continuous load path. Garage doors tend to be a big point of failure. Because they, you know, if you think your garage door isn't, you try not to have it anchored down to the ground, into the ground all the time, like the walls of your house. It's supposed to go up and down, and so it tends to not do as well. And once that is breached, then basically the garage is gone. But that's so you can do some things for your construction that can really dramatically increase your chances. And just know, and if you can't do new construction, you're not doing new construction. Go back to those basic rules. Low as you can, many walls between you as possible as a tornado, and a small interior room. We lived in the house I'm in for 14 years before we put in the in-residence shelter. We had a very small interior hallway. Everybody in the family knew that's where we went, and we used it a few times. And that was, I think that was just, and I was pretty comfortable. If you do those things, if you do the right thing, even in moderate construction, house, a moderately well-constructed house, your chances of survival are very, very high.
Okay, we're going to open up to questions now, and I have one final question for the panel when we wrap up here. So just raise your hand. A microphone will be brought your way by Jim Johnson, our program director at KGOU, and Brian Herdzinski, our operations manager. So let's go to the front row there.
Justin Murray, my question is actually for Harold and Rick, for both of y'all. As we know that products have evolved over the years, and we also include aviation as well as public information. What steps and progress is being done to try to isolate the aviation format from the public so we can allow more public-specific information? I understand the headings that come with product issuance, but is there anything being done to make it more specific to the public?
And let me kind of translate that, I think, a little bit first. By products, basically what that means is the information that is sent out by the National Weather Service, the Norman Forecast Office, in different formats and different audiences.
Right, and the Weather Service is trying to add more value or add more impact information to all of our text information that we send out. We traditionally call products things like the watches and the warnings. Watches, for example, tornado watches, severe thunderstorm watches last year got new wording in them. So now instead of just saying tornadoes, large hail, and damaging winds may happen, it'll say things like several tornadoes with a few intense tornadoes possible, or large hail, you know, 3 inches in diameter or larger. Our warnings, the most of the tornado warnings and severe thunderstorm warnings in the state of Oklahoma are changing later this month to include more impacts in those messages. So we are working to get into the 20th and the 21st century, hopefully, with some of our products. Honestly, our warnings haven't changed, and the watches haven't changed substantially since the 60s and 70s. They just don't look a lot different, and we know a lot more information. Our challenge right now is learning how to speak English and learning how to talk in a way where people get it, where they understand it, and that they do something about it. You know, Harold and I can spout off words all day long, but it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't get someone up off the couch, it doesn't matter. So I think we are working in that direction. We got a long way to go, though.
Okay, another question.
Hi, Sherry King. I was curious, you had mentioned about your in-house shelter, and so you believe that those are going to be safe for, I mean, just seems like the tornadoes have become more fierce and stronger, and so you think for the future that those are going to be a safe place?
Sure. We actually don't have any evidence when we look at tornadoes that they've increased in intensity at all. The records really don't show that. But there was an extensive study done after Moore and Joplin and I think Tuscaloosa was the third one, that the Texas Tech people who led the way in developing the guidelines, basically they surveyed every storm shelter that was hit in Moore. They walked the entire path to get every shelter, and none of the shelters that were built to standards had any problems at all. I mean, there were some pock marks in the concrete on the side where missiles had hit the outside, but that's okay. You know, the whole house was gone, and this wonderful shelter was sitting there. And they found the same thing in Joplin and Tuscaloosa. There was actually I didn't know this until just a few weeks ago. There was an apartment complex just east of the Walmart and the Lowe's, or was it Home Depot? Home Depot in Joplin, which were both destroyed. Lots of fatalities there. And this apartment complex had been built well above code. And there were a bunch of people in that apartment complex, and they were all perfectly fine.
So nothing has changed at all. The information we're conveying tonight is the same exact information. In fact, Galen Kitch, the emergency manager for Moore, and I were in this very room a little bit over a year ago giving a tornado preparedness presentation. And the information we shared that night is exactly the same as what we're sharing tonight. Nothing has changed. We don't believe tornadoes are getting necessarily more intense or worse. Safe rooms are just as safe today as they were last year. If I've got an in-ground shelter in my garage, if I had a choice, I would have an above-ground safe room, because it's just ease of use and everything else. I trust them 100%.
Michael, I want you to weigh in on that on this too. As an emergency manager, you know, for the state of Oklahoma, what do you see in terms of shelters and how people are using them and their safety?
Well, I'd have to echo some things that are already said, and that is that, again, we did come back and look at the places of people who did have the shelters before the tornadoes hit last May, and there were none of them that didn't do their job, if you will. We also saw in the case of people who didn't have shelters, in a number of cases, they survived, again, being in that lowest, centermost, away from windows place. But the cases that people didn't survive or were badly injured, those are the ones that always stand out. We need to remember that, again, like they're saying, that the tornadoes have not gotten more mean, more evil. It's just I think it comes back a little bit to the fact that we're just so overloaded with information these days, and we have to, again, back to the planning piece, know how to sift that out and know what we can trust and what we need to question so that, again, we can apply that to our planning process and keep our families as safe as possible.
It's important to remember that even in the most intense tornadoes, the area that's actually got the highest intensity is still relatively small. It's only a small part of an EF5 tornado is actually EF5 or EF4 damage. And from the Moore tornado last year, there have been some work done that was around 99% of the people who were in structures that were EF4, EF5 survived. That's important to remember. Yep. We get messages occasionally that, you know, if you don't have a special built shelter or you can't get underground, you're not going to survive. That's just simply not true. Now, if you've got the shelter or you can get underground, bully for you, that's your chances are way up. But that doesn't mean that if you don't have those shelters that and you go, you know, boy, there's nothing I can do, or I better just start. I knew of a young lady last year who called her mother to tell her she was getting ready to run from her house because her car wasn't working. And so she was ready to run away from her house because she couldn't get underground. Now, fortunately, she called her mother, and those of you who are mothers in the room will know what the mother told her to do. And she went back in the house and was fine. You know, I guarantee you it's not a fun place to be when the tornado hits the house, but your chances of survival are actually very good if you do the simple safety advice. If you get caught out in traffic, things start to get a little squirrely right there. And there were a lot of people on May 31st who never were near a tornado. The number of traffic accidents that occurred and just all of that that went on that day was really large.
And high blood pressure and stress.
High blood pressure. And people who drowned because they tried to get into drainage ditches for shelter.
I think Harold brought up an interesting point. And we talk about the May 20th tornado being an EF5 tornado. We did an extensive, almost door-to-door damage survey of that tornado. We surveyed over 4,200 individual structures. 9 of those had EF5 damage, 9 out of 4,200 and something. And the area of EF5 damage was essentially about a house wide or a lot wide. The whole thing is not an EF5 tornado, and you know you are going to be fine where you are. Shelter in place is still the message.
Another question?
Or businesses and other institutions, do you have an idea of how many days during the really severe storm season we have tornado watches in central Oklahoma, or where we can get that information? Because for people who are maybe working on plans to either get people to shelter or shelter in place, it might be kind of nice to know, well, how much downtime are we going to have if we do that kind of thing?
I knew I should have studied for this. because we just worked with the Storm Prediction Center to produce some maps of the average number of tornado watches, moderate risk, high risk, slight risk. I think for tornado watches for the central Oklahoma area, it's 10 or less. So if that's a gauge of anything...
Per year, average.
I may be a little bit off on my numbers, but I think that's the ballpark. So we're not, I mean, it feels like, and I know it's going to feel like it this spring, that it feels like, you know, we're being bombarded by storms and there's a risk of severe weather every single day and they're interrupting TV and the weather service is talking. But we really don't have, when you look at it, even here in Oklahoma, the number of days where you really need to pay attention and the number of minutes where you really need to take shelter is tiny. And if you just do it, if you're an average for central Oklahoma, you're in 1 to 2 tornado warnings a year. On average, sometimes. Last year, Cleveland County had 13 tornado warnings. That was an odd year. If you take shelter every time there's a tornado warning, that's what, an hour and a half, 2 hours tops out of your life. It's worth it.
Another question.
Yeah, hi, David Reimer. Obviously, last May 31st, we saw a mass exodus out of the Oklahoma City metro area. Much against safety advice, and obviously I don't need to go into what happened. You both were watching, I know. Is there any plans on emphasizing this season not to do that, or are there any changes in terms of, I guess, your language on why it's important to stay inside your structure and not attempt to evacuate ahead of a thunder or a tornado?
Good question. And, of course, you're referring to the panic that occurred back on May 31st and everything. I would see this coming season is going to be overly sensitive no matter what. The interest and the anxiety that is all going to come because of the next storm season is going to be concerning to everyone. I anticipate we'll all be out there with the same message we've always had, which is that you need to have that plan where you're going to be safe no matter what place you're at whenever the warning is handed down. And, of course, you decide that when the watch is issued, or when two or three days ahead of a very concerning day, National Weather Service and other partners are out there saying you need to take heed to this information. As far as keeping people from getting in their cars and trying to outrun a tornado, it's a very difficult thing to change those behaviors sometimes. But we'll be out there preaching the same thing we've said all along. Again, you know personally how the situation that's upon you, but again, we all react better, we all make better choices if we've planned ahead. And I think most times, and I think they'd agree with me, you are always going to be, most always going to be in a safer situation if you are in a building rather than in a vehicle.
And from the Weather Service perspective, our message hasn't changed at all. At 1 o'clock in the afternoon on May 31st, we told people, don't be on the roads after 4 o'clock. We told people, if you don't feel safe where you are, drive now. If you wait till the warning is issued, it's too late. That's the same message last year as it is this year. It's a horrible place to be in a car. I was stuck in traffic. I had another talk I did earlier today, and I was stuck in traffic trying to get home, and I was stressed because I was late. I cannot imagine the feeling of being stuck in traffic with a huge tornadic supercell with softball-sized hail and flooding rains and who knows what else in there bearing down on you. It's just, you know, we need to transfer some of the things we do for winter weather over to severe weather. If it's a bad winter storm, or if the road's covered in snow, you know, maybe you leave work early, or maybe you don't go get the light fixture. You know, maybe you wait till tomorrow to do that. And we need to do that more with tornadoes too. It's so easy to avoid being caught in that situation if you just pay attention.
And to me, one of the things about May 31st is that I wish I understood why it happened. I know there's some aspect of specific messaging on the day that came out, but how much of it was essentially, you know, post-traumatic stress? We'd had the 19th and the 20th, and locally we'd been in tornado watches, I think, the 29th and the 30th. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there'd been, and nothing big happened on those days, but there were watches, and I remember having to make minor changes in plans for that. And we saw back on May 24th, 2011, 2 days after the Joplin tornado, it wasn't as bad, but there was an awful lot of panicked behavior on that day, at least in Norman. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of those things that we don't. These kinds of events are at this point seem to be so unusual. I don't know if we actually know why it happened. And if we can't figure out why it happened, it's really hard to figure out how to get the messaging right to get people to not do that.
What we know is that people that did it last May 20th or May 31st, who felt like that was a good thing to do, they're alive today or whatever their, you know, their reasoning is, they'll probably do it again. We know people are going to do it. People have been doing this for years and years and years. It didn't start last year. We just hope people will look at what happened last year and think twice about it. There's cases where you have to go somewhere, but you can't wait until, if you wait until the warning is out, it's too late.
I mean, if you're the only person who goes, it's great, but, you know, 500,000 of your closest friends decide to leave at the same time, you know, that's a whole different ballgame.
It's been a long time since I saw 8 years old, and we had our car lifted up off the road when I was 8 years old, trying to get to a shelter from our perfectly nice home during a storm. Another question?
Yes, I'm Ann Masters. I'm with the Pioneer Library System, and welcome to the Moore Public Library. Public libraries are public buildings, but they're not storm shelters. They're not safety shelters. And we worry about our customers and our employees, and struggle with the question of how much time ahead if we're going to close the building so people can find a safer place to be, and then after a certain point, we don't you shouldn't be out on the road, so we do the best we can. But by their very nature, libraries are open with lots of potentially flying objects in them. And so what advice can you give to us and our customers regarding being in places like libraries during during the storms, or how much time in advance do we need to have to close?
It's all to Rick.
Well,
it's a good question for sure.
Well, in most cases for the big days, for like a May 20th, a May 31st, we're going to be able to provide you with some fairly specific windows of time where we think it's most likely to happen. On May 20th, we were saying it's going to be from 2 to 5. That was the main window. It was later on May 31st. But hours in advance, that's about as good as it's going to get. A tornado watch will come out at some point, and it'll be in effect for 6 hours, and it'll cover two-thirds of the state of Oklahoma, and that's not going to give you a lot more detail. It really just comes down, again, to monitoring the weather. On May 20th, we knew the storms were going to form just the county west of us here, and it was going to happen very fast and happen early in the day. There is no one-size-fits-all answer to that. We know that, and Mike Land can maybe address this too, we know that more and more libraries, schools, hospitals, the Moore Medical Center had 200 to 300 people that didn't really belong there on May 20th when the tornado hit. Our building had 1,100 people in it on May 31st. We are not a tornado shelter. There were 8,000 people in the OU campus taking shelter. None of those buildings are tornado shelters. So that's a we could do a whole other show on that. That's a huge issue, and it's a real dilemma because people who don't feel safe where they are want to go to a building, and they think a building like the one we're in right now, they're with other people, it's a public building, it's open, it's safe, but as you know, this is not a shelter.
Mike Lane?
I think Rick's exactly right. First of all, there's not a one-size-fits-all like that. Each storm system has its own personality and its own dangers, I would imagine, and its own circumstances to when it's going to hit, how it's going to be, and all that. And again, we continue to look to the people who understand the science to gain their knowledge. I think more than anything, it's just to be ready that as much as I can get out there and preach that you need to stay home, you need to shelter in place, you need to have a plan, there are going to be times when people just shove that aside. Even if they believed it the day before the tornado came through, the day of the tornado that they've got a warning on now, they're going to try to seek refuge somewhere else. And so I think that we could say easily, well, you should shut your doors and don't worry about it, but we can't do that, of course. So you have to have a plan. Businesses, whether it's a hospital, a library, whatever, how you're going to handle that.
And for me, one of the first things I do is that I'd make sure that you would identify, where's my staff going?
A very good point.
Because those are the people that you, at one level, you actually have a real responsibility for. And you also know they're going to be in your building. And we ran into the concept of when we were looking through, Rick and I were involved in a project looking at the Norman Public Schools plan, and from having had some other discussions, we learned of places that essentially have red, yellow, and green areas in their buildings. And red means they don't think that's survivable. And you basically, your staff should know, you know, okay, these are the green dot rooms. If we have to do something in a hurry, this is where everybody goes. If we have to use the yellow, okay, but we don't want to use that, and we sure the heck don't want to get into the red areas. And so basically your people with a little bit of training would know, okay, this is the first time I've been in the Moore Library. I've been in the Norman Library a lot more. You know, I know where the bathrooms are. I know where some of the other areas inside the offices are. I know where staff can all go in there and where customers can go. And everybody, including that, you know, that teenage volunteer who's working that evening at your office, at your building, needs to know, okay, these are the places to go so that we can get people into them.
Another question from the audience.
Yeah, how fast does a tornado go along the ground? 30 miles an hour, 50 miles an hour?
I think the answer to that question is yes. Yes, I was going to say. Harold.
On average, probably about 30 miles an hour. The fastest ones we know about run on the order of 70 miles an hour. Yeah, but 30 is more common. And 70, around here, 70 is very, very rare. That's more of a wintertime southeastern U.S. kind of phenomenon. Most of them, I'd say 30 to 40 miles an hour.
But it's never at a constant speed. They're constantly changing. The El Reno tornado went from moving 25 miles an hour to moving 50 miles an hour in the space of about 5 minutes, then did a complete circle over I-40. The Moore tornado did a complete loop, a complete circle over the 7-Eleven at 4th and Telephone Road. So they never go in a straight line, and they never travel at constant speed. But 30 is about the average. Yeah.
And one little thing I want to make sure that there may one of the misconceptions that I know about that's very local to this place is that people think that the Warren Theater is magic. Okay. The Warren Theater was basically not hit by the tornado. It survived as well as it did because it didn't get hit by the tornado. Because I'm pretty sure there will be people who will be showing up at the Warren mm-hmm. when there's a tornado watch this year, and that's just not a very good idea. The difference in the winds that the medical center got and the theater got was huge.
Which just goes to speak to the fact of how difficult it is to really know where how things are going to end up. I mean, I could keep saying, be prepared, be prepared. Is there another question from our audience?
Kurt, while we're looking for another question, just to speak to that, we are blessed and fortunate here to have incredible TV meteorologists. There's nowhere else like it on the planet where we have such intense, complete, comprehensive coverage of everything that's going on. And I mean that in a good way. But sometimes we're a victim of our own success. I heard a story after the May 20th tornado, someone that was near or at the Moore Medical Center. They kept hearing someone on TV saying it's going to hit the Warren Theater, it's going to hit the Warren Theater, and they felt a sense of relief that it was not going to hit the Moore Medical Center. Well, if you know where those two things are, there's like, you know, a parking lot in between them. We're not that good. And you should never take the times that you see on television. You should never take the exact precise street intersection locations as the absolute truth. There's always very fuzzy edges on all that. So you cannot assume, well, they say it's going to hit at 19th and Telephone Road. Well, I live at a block up the road, so I'm okay. No, there's a big buffer around that. Even here, even with the close radar, even with the coverage, you need to always assume that the information is not as precise as it seems like it is.
Yeah, and on the May 19th tornado, one of the TV stations I was hearing was talking about the fact that the circulation was going to cross the Canadian River at Lindsay and where Lindsay Street would go west. And I go, okay, I'm good on where that is. And the next time they said Maine, and I'm going, well, there's only a mile north-south between there, but with the way the river bends, there's actually 4 miles difference. And I live between Lindsay and Maine. So if the circulation's crossing the river at Lindsay, we're in the shelter. If it's crossing at Maine, we have no problems at all at home. And I started realizing, even though it's a really small difference when you look – If I'm a TV guy looking at my radar map, that actually looks like it's not much of a difference. In reality, it was a huge difference for me personally at my house, and so they maybe, you know, they're looking at a big map and they got a big blobby radar echo. Their precision and their ability to locate the exact locations is not as good as they as Rick was saying is not as good as they say they are. And if you know the local terrain, you may actually notice that at times that they're off by. You know, okay, so they're off by one pixel on the radar. That's really all we're talking about. That's not a very big error in terms of radar of reading the radar, but if you live on either side of that pixel, that's a big difference.
And we have the exact same limitations. Yeah. All radar, all meteorologists have the same problems. We don't put exact times in warnings. We don't put exact street intersection locations unless we, you know, are 100% confident that's where it is.
Or you've got a damage report.
Yeah. So precision does not always equal accuracy.
Understood. And I want to close with a question to our panel, and this is kind of an after-the-fact question again. As a research disaster recovery, one of the terms that I've come across and I hear is the term resilience. And my question to the panel, and just let's just pass it around, starting with Michael Ann, what makes a person, a family, a business, a community resilient, to have the ability to bounce back more quickly after a devastating storm?
Well, I think the number one thing is the planning again, making sure that they have a plan in place, how they're going to handle a situation that comes their way. None of us can imagine exactly how, stop talking about severe storms here tonight, exactly how that severe storm is going to impact us. but we stand a better chance of being successful and being resilient and being able to get back on our feet the more we do to prepare for that should it happen. And, of course, you got to do the preparation in advance. And we do see that with people who and we're not trying to scare people or cause them to do things that are unrealistic. We're just saying take a little time, have a plan, be prepared, have that disaster supply kit in place, and stay informed. Those are pretty easy steps. And again, as already been discussed here tonight, we're not talking about a huge block in your lifespan here. We're talking about a fairly insignificant amount of time, but it can make a huge difference, whether you are badly injured or something worse than that. And again, help you and your family be able to get back on your feet to work through that recovery process, because as all too many people here and more and other places across Oklahoma can testify, it's a tough road to get back on your feet after you've seen everything taken from you because of a tornado or a wildfire or any of the other threats that face our wonderful state.
I think Michael Ann hit on all the key points. I think we learn a lot from looking at past events, so I think we can learn a lot by looking at how the people of Moore responded to this event in Oklahoma City, Newcastle, Kearney, Shawnee, everyone that was affected by tornadoes last year, how they responded. I think Harold's got a great story. I don't know if he's going to share it about the difference that people, the difference of what people needed or wanted or looked for in the immediate aftermath of the tornado, someone who had been through other tornadoes and Moore versus new people. We learn from every experience, and I think you're going to be more resilient if you've thought about it in advance. If you talk to your insurance agent, make sure your coverage is up to date and you've got everything you need, or your important papers ready to go. The more you do before the storms are on radar, the calmer of an experience it's going to be, and you're going to be more able to bounce back after that. Because if you're not prepared and everything is just completely chaotic and your life is just completely destroyed with no structure or no planning around that, it's going to be very hard. But I think, again, we've been saying it all night, just think about it in advance, plan and prepare.
I will tell the story, but before I get to it, one thing on the community level I think is, you know, do good buildings. And I don't mean you've got to go build a reinforced concrete house for everybody going. Just do simple things. You know, I have a friend who does a lot of damage surveying. He says, yeah, he'd like to see better codes, but before we had better codes, let's just build what we have right now to code as a starting point. Something simple like that. You know, actually put the nuts on the bolts kind of thing. Use nuts and bolts rather than nails. And the story Rick was talking about was my daughter was home from college on May 20th, and she did one of those things that makes you proud as a parent. You know, she said, you know, I'm just home for a couple of weeks. I'm not doing anything. A lot of people are going to have trouble tonight, the first night at the she went up to Journey Church to work as a volunteer and just help out at the thing, because she said, you know, if I stay home, I'm just going to sleep in the morning. I might as well go up there and work all night. Well, it took about a couple hours before she was sort of the number one clothes sorter by size of stuff that was there. And one of the things she found in talking to some of the people who'd been through May 3rd was that who had been through on the relief side at May 3rd, the people who had been affected by May 3rd came in and asked for different stuff than the people who hadn't been through May 3rd. The May 3rd people all came in and asked for plastic bags so they could go take care of whatever belongings they still had that weren't ruined. The people who hadn't been through May 3rd came in and asked for some clothes so they could change clothes. And she said it was one of those they started realizing, and they started then suggesting to the people who hadn't been through May 3rd, you want to take some trash bags so you can pick up your stuff? And that was one of those things that people had learned and responded differently when they went through the second event.
Well, that's our time for now. And thank you to Michael Ann Newton, Deputy Director with the State Office of Emergency Management, Rick Smith, Warning Coordination Meteorologist with the Norman Forecast Office of the National Weather Service, and Harold Brooks, Senior Scientist with the National Severe Storms Laboratory, providing just tons of information to help us prepare for the spring storm season. Let's give them a round of applause for all their time. I also want to point out that the American Red Cross has some information in the back if you would like to start your preparedness. If you're not there yet, they have some great information there. Also, thanks to the Moore Public Library for hosting us. There are also others to thank, including the KGOU staff and management, for getting everything set up, recorded, and otherwise managed. It truly takes all of us working together to bring you events like this. And I also want to point out in particular one person, Kate Carlton. Kate, stand up. She is our reporter for the Oklahoma Tornado Project. And you can find her work and more information online at tornado.kgou.org. That's what you're seeing on the screen. And also, if you have that story idea or have some information you'd like to share with Kate, you can find her contact information online. For KGOU, I'm Kurt Gortney.
Thank you.
Thank you all
Thank
so
you.
Much.